Okay, what does it mean, do you think, when we say, I am the living tree, I am the living stone, I am the grail? Now, the common denominator among all these statements is the statement of I am. Now, one of the one way of describing I am in the Kabbalah is the God name that's given to Keter, which is Ayah. And it's linked to that, the name of God that is given to Moses in the burning bush, which is the Ayah Asha Ayah, I am that I am. Or more accurately in the Hebrew, I will be that which I will be. Similarly, the name Yud He Vav He has the meaning of existence, that I exist. But there's a much older word in that actually comes out of ancient Egyptian, that is called Anoki. And some of you will be aware of a series of shops called Anoki that used to sell amazing and beautiful multicolored clothing. But Anoki is one of the oldest words ever for the phrase I am. It comes out of the Egyptian Middle Kingdom. And from the Middle Kingdom time, it has a number of different, it has three hieroglyphs associated with it. It has a couple of series of wavy lines, which is the hieroglyph for water. It has the leaf of a reed arising out of the water. And it has a little woven basket with a handle. And Inuki in ancient Egyptian is something you find in all the sacred literature, and you find it in all the cartouches of the pharaohs, because it's the statement that says, for example, if you're Ramses II, you have your name as Ramses, but you also have a more potent name called your throne name, which in Ramses' case is Usamat Ra. Which means the blessing and upon the balance of the god Ra, the creator. But the word that accompanies it, that is associated with it, is Anoki. Anoki Usamat Ra. I am the living balance of Ra. Now, this word travels into Hebrew tradition. It's a look. It comes directly out of the Egyptian, so it's not found previously in Hebrew, and it's translated into Hebrew, and then into Christianity. Because in the Gospel of John, for example, you have Christ saying of himself, "I am the light. I am the true vine. I am the true vine," etc. But it's like a very ancient magical kind of pronouncement that relates back to the centrality of being. Because what arises out of the statement "I am" is first the assertion of our being, and then the act of creation itself. So if I am Usamat Ra, I am out of my being. I manifest the form of the creator god Ra, the sun god who creates everything, and I manifest balance. I might also say, like Seti the First, Anoki Naktset, I am the power of the god Set, the god who disturbs and breaks down, the great warrior god who's depicted on that picture above Fern's head, who moves into the darkness, protecting the bark of Ra. Now, in a sense, this statement of identity, who I am, Anoki. If we look at it in Hebrew, it begins with the letter Aleph. And the letter Aleph is the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. It's the letter of beginnings, but it's the letter of infinity. It's also the letter of unity. It has a numerical meaning. Hebrew letters are also numbers, so So numerically it's one. It affirms the unity. And there's a wonderful short story, if you ever read Borges, the great Argentinian short story writer, wrote a wonderful story called The Aleph, where he describes the Aleph as being a single point that contains all other points, all other times, all other possibilities. And if you can attune yourself to the Aleph, you attune yourself to the infinity of the web of connection. So all possible permutations arise there. The second letter of Anokhi is a letter called Nun, which does have some echoes back into the ancient Egyptian word for water, for the waters of creation, which are also called Nun. But in Hebrew tradition, it represents fish, and it has the idea of the fruitfulness of life and something arising out of the waters. So in terms of the pattern of the name Anokhi, it has the sense of something particular arising out of the limitless possibilities of the Aleph. Now this is the same as the ancient Egyptian formulation, where you have the waters of the Nun, and then you have so if the waters of the Nun, you could say literally our wave of reality, they look like waves. The single leaf of the reed, of the flower, and it's often the reeds are flowering reeds. So you have this sense of the particular arising out of the infinite potential. And what emerges in the Hebrew version of that is the fish, that the appearance of the fish, the appearance of life and movement. And which leads on to the letter K in Hebrew, which is the palm of the hand, which is the prototypical cup. Just think of it, the hand is the first cup you drink. Similarly, in the ancient Egyptian kind of version, the letter is of the hieroglyph is of a basket that is woven together, that can be held, that can contain things. The final letter of Anokhi is the letter Yud, which is the letter of creation, the ignition letter, which leads on to the formulation of Yud He Vav He, which we've been looking at in different ways. You put together Anokhi with Yud He Vav He, we get Anokhi Yud He Vav He, I am Yud He Vav He. Now what does that mean? That means I am the living image of the divine. It means I am connected to the energy of creation. Can simplify it even further, as happened in the Christian tradition, where Anokhi is contracted into being the letter Shin, which represents that sense of I amness, and represents that sense of the unmanifest breath coming into form. So there we end up with Yud He Shin Vav He, which is the chant that we use at intervals. So when we say, I am the living tree, I am the living stone, I am the grail, we're drawing on this very ancient dynamic. We're drawing on really the capacity of the ability to be able to, if you like, dissolve our fixed identity into the simple experience of being, and to enter then into this kind of, if you like, this quantum place where you're with the infinite potential, so with the Aleph. We take the stance of the Nun, which is the energy that starts to move out of that. And the rabbis do an interesting thing with the letter Yun. It's got two forms. It's got a form where it's kind of a slightly bent over letter, which they say is the bending, the bowing in humility before the unity of the divine. And then it has a straightened form, which is put always at the end of a word, which is like the letter, seed of the letter Yud, and a straight line going down, where, having bowed in humility, you receive that kind of presence, and you become, just like the reed leaf, you become this straight arrow emissary, really, of that infinity, coming into existence as the distinct particle, which then becomes the offered hand holding the seed of new life. And in a sense, when we come back to the ancient, Egyptian formulation of this, you immerse yourself in the waters of the Nun. So when we say, now do I descend into the inner sea, etc., we dissolve into that kind of formless set of possibilities, that kind of the quantum wave. When we then name what arises, we become the reed leaf, and then we become the container, the basket, within which the appearance, the living idea, the living, what the Egyptians would have called the netta, the god, the creative image, manifests as a fusion of forces and possibilities, which then has its effect in the world, and then has to dissolve again. Yeah. So what is being described here is a continual conversation between the potential endless possibilities of the wave, the emergence of the particle, the perception of the particle, to use that word, the particle then having its effect, and then dissolving again back into the limitless possibilities. And in a certain sense, this is something that is continually happening, moment by moment by moment. The ancient Egyptians glyph it out, really, in the idea of the sun rising, coming into kind of full maturity in midday, becoming old, and then entering into the underworld, becoming young again and becoming reborn again. So this is and there's a lot to do with the ancient Egyptian conception of time, where they had two conceptions of time. One, which is called Nene time, which is that kind of repetition of cycles. And the other one is called the Jet time. And Jet is like, again, that straight arrow, that the simple moment where everything kind of aligns. And is seen as ultimately stable, ultimately kind of beyond time, and it's like the straight and the spiral that we have here. Now, these are things you find in all traditions, this is a fundamental aspect of being a human being. And so all the different inner traditions of the world have their own versions of this.
To be able to find it as well as that, as well as all the inner traditions, but to find it in scientific experiment is also, that's profound, really. There's not many things you can think of that are so overtly kind of spiritual, yeah, but then can be shown in the most rigorous scientific experiments.
And that's the miracle of it, isn't it? In a way, that whole thing about the quantum and quantum physics is why we need brilliant interpreters like Carlo Rovelli, for example, who can show it to us. So you start to see that what's being described from different viewpoints is a reality that's underneath, right? So that's it. In a way, that's the sort of encouraging and important thing, that it's not an artifact of a particular imaginative dialogue. These are all different ways of describing an underlying reality.
And we're in, to carry that forward, yeah, we're in a kind of an incredible place in time, because we scientifically, we don't understand why it works. Mm. Even like Ravelli and all the rest of it, they don't know why it works yet.
Yeah.
But we can see the, and we can use the results in myriad applications. But it's something we don't understand. I did wonder the other day. I wondered, is that what the future of AI is? Is AI going to understand this stuff and then explain it to us? Maybe that's an optimistic view of AI, but it is incredible, isn't it? But
there it is. And if you take some of the ideas of quantum physics, if you take entanglement, for example, right? You know, entanglement. You know, these ideas. Only just let you just think about them. So entanglement is the way two particles become entangled and can communicate instantaneously, even though they're separated by thousands of miles. Now, entanglement is another way of describing what I would call the web of exchange, or the Buddha would call it, what call codependent arising, where the Buddha's teaching comes out of a single sentence really, which is from the arising of this that arises, this being that comes to be. From the ceasing of this, that ceases. This being not, that becomes not. Where this and that is everything. Then later on in Buddhism, you get these very powerful poetic images of the net of Indra, which is a net of jewels, each jewel of which reflects and images every other jewel in the web. And so all these are different ways of describing both our universality and our particularity. So you just take that imagery of being the jewel, the node in the net that reflects every other jewel. You know, so therefore your nature is vast beyond measure, and yet you are located in a particular place, particular movement through time.
Holographic.
It's absolutely holographic. But when you really properly let that in, what are the consequences of that? Consequences of that really are, of course, is there is no separation. And each affects all, and all affects each. And when we're living in terrible times, like we are, it's very easy to feel that what I think, what I feel, what I believe, what I imagine, it is of no meaning. You know, it's very easy to give up and lose hope. But actually, if we remember what the inner traditions are trying to tell us, that actually our ability just to simply to be the grail, to be the stone, to be the tree, in itself has effect just as an act of intention, just as an aspiration, just as a... because the web, because we reflect and contain all other possibilities. Now, what happens to us as we move through time and space, is certain potentialities get actualized and others are not so actualized. And that has a lot to do with our own, if you like, individual track in space and time. But all of us carry, if you like, the fundamental divine name of Anuki and all the other names that arise out of that. So if I think of another illustration from Egyptian tradition, if I think of the first female pharaoh of Egypt, pharaoh in her own right, was Neferu Sobek, also called Sobek Neferu. And so you find her cartouche saying Anuki Neferu Sobek, I am the beloved one of Sobek, who is my beloved. Now Sobek is the crocodile god of the Fayum in Egypt. And that statement of I am the beloved one, the merit Neferu, I am the beloved Neferu, the beloved and beautiful one of the beautiful and beloved god Sobek. Now that is a sort of effectively an act of magic. It's a priestly act. She is the priestess, is proclaiming her identity as the as the avatar, as the priestess who transmits the essence of the god Sobek, who is the crocodile god of life and death in the Fayun. And in a way we can, you know, it's very dramatic when we say that, but actually that place of being the, if you like, the priest or priestess of the universe, this is a function that all human beings have. Because at each moment when we affirm, whether consciously or unconsciously, when we affirm the nature of our being, we bring into being an image, an idea, a thought, a sense of who am I and what is the universe in which I live. And so that sense of the incarnating energy that moves through us into the web, enters then into the community of conversations that create and maintain the universe. And likewise, we ourselves are affected by that community of conversations. Now, the reason I bang on so much about the icon and the idol is that what happens to human beings is they get stuck. All kinds of reasons why people get stuck. Trauma, difficulty, fear mainly, actually mostly. And the accompanying rage that comes with it. But what happens with the getting stuck is we become separated from the communication, separated from the conversation, from the particle wave conversation is the deeper root of our being. And what then happens is our conversation, instead of reaching out and being part of the larger conversation, becomes a form of self-talk, where we self-reify. I become Ian, with Ian's history, and Ian's view of the universe, and Ian's hatred of fairy balls and such like, and wants to pull the wings off the fairies. It's kind of funny, but also in the end, stop it. We've all heard it before anyway. You know, all of that. Right. And what happens in that is that you enter into a sort of staleness. The staleness of memory. The staleness of air that's been recycled too long and too often. And that doesn't have the divine breath coming through it. But to enter into the larger, that larger conversation requires a certain willingness to lay yourself down, to become the living bridge, to enter into, in a certain sense, to enter into death, to be made alive again. My little cat Oberon has taught me a lot about resurrection, in that he continually nearly dies and comes back to life. Well, actually, once he did die and come back to life with the assistance of Phoebe, a wonderful doctor, vet. Oberon's just been through another process where he's dying, he's come back to life. And so Oberon's really helped me look at the fragility and the power of life. Really, and the necessary vulnerability if we're going to enter into this dynamic between the wave and the particle. Now, if we do allow ourselves to enter into that, we can allow ourselves the vulnerability of that. We're held by something bigger, we're held in a bigger conversation, we're held by this sense of the web. But that often feels quite insubstantial. It feels not enough. And one of the dangers really in those moments is that we retreat into a slightly more limited sense of self, which feels more solid, and feels safer because of its seeming solidity, because we're pulling in and densifying our energies into the away from the unknown into the known. And what then happens is a certain degree of antagonism starts to happen between the known and what is known, not unknown rather. So there's so we set up a sort of a dichotomy, a splitting, a dualism where once there was an unity. And what we seek to do then is to manipulate, having found that sense of solidity, if you like, that reified solidity, we then seek to protect that solidity. Even if that solidity isn't great, really, it becomes bearable and becomes ours and becomes known. And despite the staleness of it, there's a sort of comfort in that kind of staleness, where we can sort of hide. You know, there's a sort of we retreat away from the possibilities, the multiple possibilities. Now, if I come back to the word anuki, what you have there is the sense of the Aleph, which is the infinite possibilities, all the waveforms that arise. Then we have this sense of the letter Nun, the fish that swims in the sea that arises out of that. And then we have the open hand that manifests the spark of life that then becomes the living image. Now that, all that gesture is a gesture of openness and vulnerability, as opposed to the pulling in, the separating, the kind of okay, step back and leave me alone, draw the ring around myself, and then recycle within the ring. And one of the ways the Kabbalah talks about what happens to us in that is the ossification of the heart, the development of something that, if it continues hard, long enough and hard enough, becomes the heart of stone. And the image they have for that is called the maskul, which means the obstruction, something that is solid obstruction, that obstructs the light. And then the root image behind that is a deeply inscribed stone, which can only reflect that which is inscribed upon it, which is that which arises out of its past. So the memory of Ian and Ian's universe is the inscription upon the heart of stone, as opposed to the living, the heart of flesh that is continually beating, continually aware, continually open to new sets of possibilities. And in a way, just in terms of the imagery we've been looking at, the difference between the living stone and the heart of stone. The living stone has the capacity to earth, to embody, to make solid. It has that particle capacity. But it also is in touch with the fluidity and the movement of the wave. It's always ready to open into the next moment, to open itself into fluidity again, into the flowing energy of the chalice, into the life that arises in the tree. The heart of stone becomes solid, becomes known, becomes certain. And there is a power in that. There is a potency in that. People will follow you if you have that kind of certainty. And you put out that this is the way, as opposed to inviting people into the mischievous conversation. Now, one of the key books behind the Kabbalah, really, from the Bible, is the Book of Ezekiel. And the Book of Ezekiel has a lot of stuff in it, really. But one of the elements in it that I've always found very important is there's a moment where, in vision, Holy One shows Ezekiel a corrupted temple in the heart of Jerusalem, the temple, corrupted. And what we're shown is the elders of Zion, the elders of Jerusalem, which are the priests, the high priests, having become corrupt, and instead of being the transmitters of the life and the breath and the blessing of the name, are locked up in their, and they use this very particular word, they are locked up in their own chambers of imagery. They have developed a heart of stone and are locked in their own chambers of imagery, creating darkness. And they feel safe in the darkness because the divine cannot see them. So the fields of darkness that are generated by the elders of Israel are designed to keep away, to resist the possibility of entering into the living dialogue. And the interesting thing really about the phrase the elders of Zion, we're talking there about people who are accomplished, skilled, not idiots, not fools, people who have developed considerable inner and outer abilities. And the role of an elder in the community, of course, is to pass on the wisdom, is to transmit teachings, is to enable a new generation to make their connection with each other and with life and the energies of life itself. Now, if the elders have turned away from that capacity and turned inwards into their own chambers of imagery, they've entered into this self-reification where the God that they worship is the image of themselves, the heart, the idol that is a reflection of their own self, their own sense of self and sense of the universe that they have, that they inhabit. Now those images can be very beautiful. They're not necessarily terrible or don't necessarily look terrible. They can look beautiful. They can be very kind of seductive. But because what is not in them is humility, what is not in them is the ability to bow, to surrender, to enter into not knowing, and entering into death so that new life can emerge. So when we come to the wizard Merlin who we find in the Arthurian literature, and when he's portrayed as the know-it-all powerful wizard who manipulates those around him, what we're being presented with is the image of someone who has developed the heart of stone, who knows the way and manipulates others through his knowledge of the universe, his knowledge of the secrets of things. And it translates not just for old Merlin, it translates into many of the different traditions of the West, where you, this idea of knowing the secret name, or the ability to, if you have the secret names, you can summon spirits and they will do your bidding. My friend Ben runs Courtyard Books. If you go into Courtyard Books, one of the things that the whole sea genre of books, the most popular things he sells for enormous prices often, are grimoires which show you how to summon spirits and devils and all kinds of exciting gothic-y things. That all of which were you to do that, all of which reinforce your sense of I am this magical, powerful being. Spirits obey me. as a.
To be clear, this iteration of Merlin is the Geoffrey of Monmouth one.
No, it's not the Geoffrey of Monmouth is a different. I'm going to come on to him, because what we see with Geoffrey of Monmouth Merlin is a completely different version.
Yes, you're talking about the generic Merlin, who is a magician.
Mallory onwards. Mallory. Right? So basically, so when we encounter Merlin in Mallory.
Thank you.
Right. Well, no, not at all. You get a vestige of him. He's a bit of a shape changer, but actually the sense you get when you look at Merlin and Mallory is of this person who is moving everybody around.
Yeah.
Right. He knows what he's about, and he's kind of and he's manipulating things so that he shape changes Gorlois, so he so he looks like Gorlois. So that Igraine sleeps with him, and he begets, and Arthur is born. So what you have there in Mallory is that version of Merlin. Now, when we come to, so I'm going to go jump back. Let's see. I'm going to jump back into Merlin. I've flung a lot of stuff at you. Any questions or thoughts about some of the stuff I've been talking about before I bring Merlin into the equation?
There was one thing that occurred to me. It's a linguistic thing that we don't do ourselves any favours in English when we say, what do we mean by I am the Grail, I am the this, I am the that.
Yep.
First Nations people don't have nouns. They say, I am being this. So you are being tree, you are being bird. So that argues a fluidity. So we could say, I am grailing.
Yep.
You know, in the way you say, we can actually be at any point in different points of our lives. We can be at any point of the tree. Don't have to work up it. You know, we just embody those qualities. So a point when we're being regenerative for someone, we are grailing. When we're being grounded and fruitful, we are treeing. When we're being, maintaining continuity, we are stoning. Just a thought.
No, I mean, that's interesting, because had you been a native speaker of Pali, the ancient Indian language, time of the Buddha, that's exactly how you'd have spoken. There are no nouns in Pali, so that's why Pali words are really long, because they're descriptors rather than, but in the tradition that. The thing is that the linguistic tradition, even though we draw upon, isn't just English. It goes right back as far as ancient Egypt. So in terms of the way the West has developed even a linguistic formulation of I am this.
Yeah.
It's a sort of the much much easier actually if in some of the Indian languages, because they have a completely different linguistic kind of root in that sense. And the problem is, it's lovely to say I am grailing, but the problem is I am, and the noun has a much in linguistically is hardwired into us.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. So there's a way in which to soften it in that way is great, but if I say I am angry, right? So I become angry. Right, I am peaceful. In a way that formulation itself is actually very kind of important, because that's kind of how our unconscious patterning works somewhere. Mm. Now we can soften that by saying I am feeling angry or I am being angry, but actually if you come back to it, I am angry. Right, and if you listen to that formulation, you will feel it more. I am being angry. Well, that helps a bit, but that doesn't as well. So I am angry. If I can stay where I am angry, and then if I can fold that back into I am. So the formulation is quite precise. I am Anoki. I am. And if you like, then the God image or the living image that comes through me is angry, right? So if I then inhabit angry, if I am present with Anoki, if I don't separate angry from Anoki, what happens is something that a different kind of alchemy starts to happen. What happens is if I am angry, if I separate that from the direct feeling of Anukhi, I become angry. I don't think you can feel the distinction. I lose the connection of I amness. Whereas if I bring I amness into the heart of that, whatever the living idea is coming through me, that dissolution immediately starts to happen, because that sense of being, of presence, of being in the, subverts or alters the manifest form. It makes it part of the conversation, part of the flow.
And that is why when people manifest anger, they find a million creative ways to express it in order to hold on to it.
Yes. Well, it's a living idea, right? So if we think about this, that I am angry, then everything makes me angry, right? So and I can justify, and what do you get? And it's a generative idea. So it generates like connection, all kinds of connections with everything that is annoying, and everything is difficult, and then you can create arguments and justifications, and before you know it, you've created a whole universe, a self-justified universe of why I'm angry, why I have a perfect right to bop you on the head, because, you know, this is the end of superstructure, the underpinning enables me to do this, so I am righteous in my doing. Now that is really that's when the idol comes into full expression. Really, and not interrupted by anything. The whole nature of idols really, is idols are fed. Now, what idols are fed by are things that affirm their separate existence. The icon is continually in that dialogue where it enters into it, emerges. Anger in its purest form. So I'm angry. Come out. If I remain connected to Anukhi, that anger has a clarity and a purity about it that travels wherever it needs to travel. I mean, Tibetans, for example, talk about anger as being like white water, like the water of a Himalayan stream that pushes all the rubbish over the stream. So the purity of anger, which takes us into the Sefira Gebura, which is that kind of clarifying energy, that but then returns back into I am, that continual Anukhi.
Something like a kind of magic spell in those two, the relationship between those two words, the I and the am. The one is the separation and one is the isness, kind of plural thing. And if you say I am angry, you're kind of conjuring the spell of
anger, yes, totally.
But if in the sense of an Anukhi, with the names that follow and the things that follow, that seems like it's more like an acknowledgement of a plurality, a sort of not an I that's separate. It's not saying I, it's a separate thing, am. It's kind of saying you're in that.
This is a very difficult story, but well, that you're entering into the plurality. The one of the interesting things of the structure of Anukhi, certainly in the original Egyptian, is that what is constructed as I enter into amness, as the I enters into amness, right? So that in itself is an act of creation. From the simple sense of I-ness, which you could say is kind of unmanifest. So I-ness is unmanifest. It's just simple. Amness is an assertion of existence. So it's the reed leaf arising out of the waters of the Nun and flowering as itself. But then it creates, and then creating out of itself the woven reed basket that contains then the image, the living idea that will come through it. And so of course when you return from that living image, you come out of amness into the simple sense of I, which is then potential existence but not yet existent. I am is an assertion. That's why it's the single point, the singularity point that arises out of the infinity of potential. And we're doing all, you know, it's sort of difficult to put all this into words, right? But we're doing this all the time, right? And have been, ever since we were born. And even before that, right? So we are in a constant dialogue.
There was something really important, the image when you drew that kind of circle of separation.
Yeah.
And it brought it back into the term that, you know, I've heard you say so many times of the centre that is everywhere, the circumference that is nowhere.
Exactly so.
And somehow that spinning wheel at the bottom of the tree, I was always seeing that more in this direction. But when you shared that image then, it was that place of that circle of separation rather than the continual experiencing.
Yeah, exactly.
And that was really helpful to think almost kind of this image, isn't it? That place of how out of balance the I am angry and therefore I have the right to be angry, and how that circle then becomes a fractalization of every other circle of anger that
gets
fitted into it.
Yes, exactly.
So you suddenly get this stacking up of, of perspective instead of not having that boundary of a perception and therefore being in fluid conversation where boundaries can come and go and meet, and we always have the potential then of them stacking up in very different ways.
Yes, exactly, completely. Mm-hmm. The difference there is that even a continual conversation that can create new iterations, new possibilities, as opposed to the collection around a centre. So the separated thing, separated circle, creates that point that collects things that are sympathetic to it and pushes away anything that is antithetical to it. So it pushes, so there is no conversation, there is a continual reification, and therefore a demand comes out of that place that the universe conform both to our perceptions and our will, really. So it, we become increasingly more and more separated when that happens.
It makes me think of the Buddhist practice of saying, I am prune, I am not prune, I am a woman, I am not a woman, and just repeating anything and everything that seems to be an I am statement. It's different from the way we're using I am here, but that deconstruction of the locked in perception.
Exactly, it has the same effect. So how we use words and how we kind of, in that sense of the, my name when you hear, but yeah, it's that interesting thing that people, you know, if somebody calls your name, they may not be referring to you. So if I hear the name Ian, something perks up in Ian. You know, because the sense of Ian is embedded, and they may not be talking to me at all. But Ian, you know, even sometimes to just to contemplate that phrase, I am, well, as Steve just said, I am Ian, I am not Ian. When we do that, that can lead us into some interesting places in ourselves, really, in terms of understanding what we collect and what we push away. You know, so there's a a great deal, you know, a great deal in all of this, in a way.
It's like at the beginning of every thought, in a way.
Yeah.
I am whatever we're thinking. Like Descartes, I am thinking, therefore I am.
I am not completely. I mean, Descartes absolutely talking with this territory.
I am
silent.
I am.
Yes, exactly, right. So that sense of understanding that and touching that, right, as we let ourselves lightly touch that without getting too obsessed by it, we start to create and deepen a different kind of conversation. We can catch the I am-ness as an activity arising out of the mysterious stillness inside us. Then we increasingly open ourselves to that deeper kind of conversation.
And going into the I am, you know, somebody has really upset me and I'm genuinely angry about it.
Yeah.
And then if I just go into the I am, you know, what happens to the that which was not justified?
Well, if you stay with, the point about this is if you stay with I am, it's not about separating, it's not about getting rid of I am angry, right? I am upset, I am angry. we connect I am, Enoki angry, Enoki upset, Enoki hurt. Right? What you do is you connect the sense of I amness with the energy, the form that's living, that's moving through us. So it's the opposite of dissociation. You enter more deeply into the living form that's arising in you by becoming more and more present inside it.
Mm. Okay.
So it isn't about splitting away from that. It's not about pushing it down. It's actually connecting that and feeling then what happens when I am really present in the middle of that experience. And what happens is something alters in it normally.
One is thinking, I am angry, and then there's angry. Mm. Angry sitting in the body has a lot of energy with it and a lot of sensation with it.
Yeah.
So that's different.
Well, when I'm thinking, it's language that's complicated. When I say I am angry, I'm not just meaning the thought I'm angry,
mm-hmm.
right? So because at the level of what we're talking about the manifestation through us of living ideas that are, as they incorporate in us, are their thought. Yes, there is a thought in it, but they're also a feeling. It's also an emotion. It's also a body sensation. It's all of that really. So we're not thinking, the thought is one of the smallest bits of that. You know, I am angry is my felt sense, my upset emotions, my body experience, my perceptual experience as well. Because when I am angry and when I, you know, the world becomes hostile or difficult or you know, hateful or whatever. So I enter into, and if I connect, keep that connected to Enoki, instead of pushing that away or judging that, a different quality enters into my experience of anger or fear or sorrow or whatever it is that's arising in me.
You're talking about awareness.
Yes, of course. I'm using that. Yes, but
I'm noticing I like this.
Yeah.
So I have a moment out going, I'm like this, whatever, for this, I'm angry, and I'm back in it, and then I'm out of it.
Yeah.
That tick-tock in between.
Yeah.
I think sometimes when we feel angry, we can feel like we're separate from life, or life separated something from us.
Yeah.
But sort of trying to explore is that actually, if we say Enoki angry, there isn't
the
separation. It belongs in that whole contained.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, totally. Right, so the anger is not separate from anything, and we are not separate from anything. We're contained within this community of the discourse of the universe. And therefore our anger has a meaning, therefore our anger has an intention, and we can... And we're less likely just to do reactive anger. Because the reactive anger comes out of the place of separation, right? Where we become separate, where we become at war with the universe, where we can do, you know, terrible things because we don't feel them. We become separated off.
Yeah, they're really different feelings, aren't they? I mean, because with reactive anger, you can feel yourself as two people because there's a part of you that might not be able to control the part that's doing the anger, but is really aware of what is happening. Mm. Whereas to feel righteous anger at some injustice in the world is a completely different experience, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. So is it about, I'm trying to struggle, is it about in some way the unity, is it the permission to have it as what it is rather than pushing it away, or liking it, or a whole bunch of stuff that can go around.
Yeah, that comes after. It's about letting it be there, but it's letting it be connected to your sense of living existence, right? So that sense of I am.
Okay.
Right, so I am angry. It takes me into that sense of, if I keep that connected to Enoki, I'm connected into... So, you know, something that then holds that anger. So that image of ancient Egyptian image is quite handy, really. Well, actually, both the Hebrew one is as well. Because the, if you like, in the Hebrew image, you've got the palm being held, the yod, which is the seed of whatever is emerging, is held in the palm of the hand. So it's held. Similarly, in the Egyptian image, you've got this woven basket that holds the living image. So what is emergent is held in connection with the origin place, the place of the originating consciousness, the mysterious awareness, and the arising of our particle nature as a particular version of the infinite. And when we're holding it all together, that in that way, whatever emerges, even if it's difficult stuff, in all kinds of ways, it softens and changes and starts to become, and remains. You remain, if you like, in touch with the heart of flesh rather than the heart of stone. And in a way, that's in the Book of Ezekiel. You have this whole thing, really, where the Ezekiel, who is the priest who is in connection with the living heart, as that projects his presence into the corrupted Jerusalem, and works with the energies of the cup and the sword, breaking down the places of darkness, and gathering up the bones of holiness, so they are returned into the great communication of the living. And in a way, that's the activity of Enochi, as we kind of remain present, even with very difficult and split off parts of ourselves and the world, that sense of awareness, that sense of pure presence that enters in, breaks down the sense of separation and gathers back in the root of the energy, the root of the separated energy, and includes it in this beautiful image they have in Hebrew tradition of being the great bundle of the living. So you return to the bundle of the living. You return to be part of the woven basket. You're one of the reeds in the reed bed that arises out of the deep waters of creation. And you know yourself as... the great Sufi Rumi has this wonderful image, because it's a very ancient image, the reed bed and the waters. And his book, The Mathnawi, begins with the song of the reed. And the song of the reed is this desire, and they use reed flutes in Persia. Well, incidentally. And the song of the reed, or the song of the reed flute, is this desire to return to the reed bed, to return to the divine root and the waters of the divine. These images that you can see are deeply woven into a Western inner tradition and come up in all kinds of different places. But the process that's being described is a very fundamental human process that happens to us all the time. And that has a great deal to do with what's happening to us in the world and to the world at the moment, where there's so much happening that is about separation rather than the union and communion.
I have a little practice that I just, if I'm like, I am angry, I am what? And then the next bit is always for me, am I in a place of co-creativity?
Mm-hmm.
And that's that coming back into
the so that I brings am. You back. Because that brings you back into the I am. Yeah.
No, I'm not. I'm just blah, blah, blah. Oh, okay. Well, how do I get back there then?
Yeah.
So am I in
the
place of co-creativity?
Yeah. No, that's a good way to do it, right? Because actually what we need, because what happens when we're separated, we need something, that there's some practice or other that can bring us out of the place of separation. Yeah. And
it's like a bridging phrase.
Yeah, so that's a bridging phrase, exactly. You can see that's a bridging phrase. It actually would start to wake you up a bit and then help you to realign yourself. You know? Yeah, totally.
So powerful, so like, you know, in that film where they all start saying, I'm Spartacus.
Yes.
And then we had that, I am Charlie Hebdo. And
yes.
Mm. Mm. So you remember. have. I would say I am angry, or I'm lonely, or I'm annoyed, or I'm miserable, or whatever. You imagine everyone in the world saying that at some point, and suddenly it's not your individual sort of excommunication.
Yes. No, that's the important thing, actually. That's a really important thing you just said. Because actually, when we bring the awareness into that in that way, we enter into communion. So anger then becomes a place of connection. Sadness becomes a place of connection and not separation. And in a way, that's the... and so the, if you like, the heart of stone softens into becoming the heart of flesh. The responsive heart, the heart that reaches out and knows itself to be not alone because it can do that.
Can I give an example? And I don't think I understand you really, but as an example, the other day I was really angry.
Yeah.
And I really didn't need to be angry. Some people saying, and I couldn't work out why I was so angry. I was, you know, just come on. And then I lay in bed and thought, why am I so angry?
Yeah.
And like when suddenly it came to me, I'm tired of giving. I just can't give anymore. All the anger just dropped away, and I was all smiles and light the next day.
Yeah.
So, was I doing what you're suggesting, or was I just
doing
some psychological work?
No, I think it's what Prune's just saying, it's a bridging phrase, right? So you're using a bridging technique that actually by helping, by understanding, so your understanding of why brought you out of the vortex.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because it's that shift, right? So whatever, so when we're in that, we all need things that help us get out of that entrapment, if you like, mm-hmm. in that rather very fixed form and reified conversation. And so by being able to understand why you were angry, which is presumably sounds like you might have had demanding guests, possibly outrageously demanding guests, right? So that's great. So that's a wonderful thing. Oh, just like that. Oh, that's why. Okay, right, fine. I've had it. Right. So just that realization, that shift then that happens in the body, of course, frees you to come just to be more authentically yourself again. Because you're outrageously demanding people, then trap this. Because that's the other thing that happens, right? Of course, in this, because we don't live in an isolated world, there are people's conversations and trap us in conversations. I mean, obviously you can literally do that when we're talking to people, but much more that conversation of being between people to get us into a shared reality that isn't always good for us, really. And so as we kind of understand that, as we make a shift out of that, we come back to ourselves, we come back to Anoki, I am. We turn into my own sense of I am-ness, which is my own direct relationship with the universe and the particularity of the light and energy that moves through my being.
I guess you're saying like there might be a purpose for the anger, and we want to understand the purpose for the anger,
yeah. But
then let the anger go, otherwise we're
stuck. No, it's not that you let the anger go, right? This is kind of an important difference, really. No, you can, because that can then set up another secondary, because it can very often you can get into a fight with yourself. I should let the anger go, right? So if you try and let the anger go, if I try to do that, normally I get more angry and I get more frustrated, right? It doesn't work. It's more I'm just present in the middle of that experience with anger. And if I can trust that, now this is the difficult bit there, because I have to trust the unknowing of that. Rather than, if I can stay present in it, something will shift.
Really like trusting there's a reason for the anger, so it's okay to be with it.
Not even, well, if that helps you, that's great, right? But it's more fundamental than that. It's connecting the anger to the sense of being. We can just feel, allow yourself to feel Anoki anger. I am angry. So just, not even, because sometimes even trying to find, sometimes finding a reason, and Andy's description is a good description of that. Andy found a reason for why she was angry. Yeah. Okay, and that really worked, and that can really work, right? So the purpose is like, oh, and that's why.
Or, stop being angry.
And then you stop being angry. So that can really work. It doesn't work for everybody, right? That's Andy's particular creative formulation. So for you, there will be, if you let yourself be present in the heart of the anger and stay with it, not separate from it, something will shift. Don't know what, right? Because it's very particular, and it varies from occasion to occasion as well.
It's quite hard, isn't it, to be with anger, because we're told, don't be angry,
yeah.
And
no,
our relationship as a society, as a culture with anger,
yeah,
is
yeah,
quite a tricky one.
No, it's very unhealthy, our relationship with anger, and particularly in British culture in particular, because British culture specialises in passive aggression as the main form of anger, which means you split from anger and you bury it. And then before you know it, you're knifing people in the back and doing shit things to them which you justify. You know, anger is a very difficult one.
Yeah.
But the practice isn't an easy practice, but it's a practice of staying present in the heart of that experience, which then transforms that experience by participation in it. But you have to be what happens there is you have to be vulnerable to the unknowing of that experience by just letting it touch you, letting it feel. And you contain it, but you feel it, and then you let it move you in whatever way.
And then you move beyond.
Exactly right.
Yeah, it's the containing it.
The containing it, so that's why that image, you know, in the Hebrew formulation you have the hand that holds the seed, or in the Egyptian formulation you have this woven basket that contains, so you contain it, and then something else happens then.
Maybe it's the difference between it containing you and you containing it.
Yeah.
When it contains you, you can't see the outsides of it.
No, you can't.
You get knocked into it.
No, you get swallowed by it, right? And that's when we're talking about the idols. The idol swallows you, and then you have to obey the demands of the idol. And the nature of idols is they always need feeding, right? So the great image of the idol you have in the Bible is the idol of Moloch, who is the baby-eating idol. Now, the babies are all our unformed thoughts, right? So everything has to be funneled into this particular shape. So all our creative possibilities, instead of being able to manifest in a thousand different colours, are fed to Moloch, the inner idol, that consumes all that and translates it into its own substance.
That it's very difficult when you're trying to navigate between staying in the conversation but also stepping out of the kind of collective idol.
Yes. Oh, yeah, no problem.
Because it feels like that's part of the belonging.
Yes, thing. Totally.
And yet that's an idol kind of
thing. Oh, completely. No, totally. Look, we've only got to look at social media, right? So the sounding chambers of social media are, you know, they're built for the generation of idols. If you look at the idea of an influencer, a social media influencer, which has become a profession, and is now a profession, that is powerfully influential in the way our world works. Now, if we look at what a classic influencer has to do, they have to create an image of themselves that they have to continually feed and continually put out. You know, and because of their followers, and this whole thing of, and if you think how money follows that, you know, if you have a certain number of followers, money comes to you. Power comes to you, money comes to you. But in order to keep your profession of being an influencer going, you have to keep the likes going, you have to keep the numbers of followers going. You're locked, therefore, into a codependent relationship with an image of yourself and other people's image of you that's mutually reinforcing.
The Conservative Party, it seems to burn itself out, doesn't it? The collapse of it was when it's just everybody stopped believing it in the end because it didn't go anywhere. But then it reforms elsewhere.
That's right.
Yeah.
I'm interested in this collective thing because we have got a sort of prescribed way of working in the world. And I think I've just been thinking of several instances now where someone didn't join in the conversation of disagreement. And it's quite marked when that happens. It's like sort of a social thing stops, and usually the person who's angry is maybe shamefaced, but certainly has to retrench and take a much better position to try and explain themselves, simply because someone has not reacted in in the expected way.
Exactly, right, because that's right. Because by not reacting, by coming back into yourself, you stop feeding the dynamic of the island.
Mm,
so even by just sitting there and doing nothing, your silence is powerful.
It's so unmistakable when it happens.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah. And it's how I got rid of my troll. They are personal story, folks. I got trolled. I was really cross.
Oh, you did. Yeah.
I was so cross, I threw out cross emails to everyone I know. Guess what's happened to me? All that. And then I thought, hang on a minute. This is going to make it worse and worse and worse. And then, bad way of dealing with it. And every time I post now, I get a heart from a certain person.
Yes, there was it. Because actually what you did there, because you know, talked about it, is you move towards that person. You alter the conversation. You reframe. You just reframe. But it was dependent upon you coming back to yourself, which is that act of Anoki, and coming back to yourself and experiencing that coming back into my own sense of presence, and instead of being locked in that conversation, which certainly is what that person was trying to evoke from you, you then have a new creative flow happen.
Yeah.
And you step towards that person, now they're sending you love hearts instead of kind of, attacking Penny Billington. You know, it was a really good example of that, I think. It is indeed the act of being worthy. I tell you what, let's just stop and have a cup of tea. Where are we? Oh yes, we've got 3:10. So let's have a cup of tea, and then I'll show you how all this relates to being worthy.